Good morning, all. Before we start, I just want to express on behalf of Judge Sykes and myself the appreciation that we have in the for Judge Randa, a distinguished judge of the Eastern District of Wisconsin, who is sitting with us, and we're privileged to have him.
Thank you, Joe.
A veteran jurist, and we can always use the help.
Nice to be here.
Our first case for argument this morning, Teamsters Local versus the Burlington Northern. Mr. Kelfoth?
Yes, sir.
If it may please the court, my name is Nicholas C. Kefalis. I represent all of the appellants in this case. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to make this oral argument. And rather than rehash what the court has read in counting the appellee's briefs alone and over 100 pages, I would like to touch on three principal points. And before I get into those points, I'd like to quickly go over what I believe are the principal facts of the case, so I can build and explain. The Corwith Yard was built back in 1887, has been owned by the railroad ever since its construction. The railroad has been in existence for over 160 years. The Teamsters' relationship with the yard has been 60-plus years. It was at that time that the Teamsters created a health, welfare, and a pension plan. There are two separate health, welfare, and then there's the pension plan. The railroad had a labor contract with the Teamsters that was in full force in effect. The Teamsters were the sole bargaining agent for all of the workers at the yard. And
the collective bargaining agreement runs between the railroad and the Teamsters, not between RTS and the Teamsters?
Well, this is the interesting wrinkle of this case, and I think maybe the reason why we're here is because of my difficulty in explaining the fact that the railroad has been operating the yard either by itself or it has created its own subsidiary within itself to operate the yard, or other times it has brought in an operator to operate the yard, or it has created an operator through employees of its own or other employees of an intermodal operator. And so what brings us here today, and the reason why I think that the intermodal case is so important, is because in the intermodal case, which principally this case is built upon, is the railroad was operating the Hobart Yard in California by itself, and it operated through this subsidiary called Santa Fe.
Right. The problem with the analogy to the Ninth Circuit case is that that's an outsourcing case, and this is effectively an insourcing case.
Right. It's just the only, I believe, the factual difference is it brought in an operator and used that to destroy the pension in that case. And in this case, it did the opposite to have the same effect. And so the three points that I would like to go over is our claim plausible? Is an interference claim against employer, non-employer actionable as the statute is written? And number three, we argue that there's no requirement for an interference claim under the statute for the interference to be successful for the claim to get past the pleading stage. And plausible, it's clearly plausible based on the four principal cases that we cite on our brief. Ultimately, the claim is that all of the defendants or all of the workers were terminated in order to prevent them from accruing years of service and from obtaining full retirement benefits. And that's principally on all fours. That's the Nemeth case, that's the Gary case, and that's the Foltz case.
If I could clarify something.
Yes.
You're litigating this case, as I understand, both the complaint and your briefing, both in the district court and here,
yes,
as a retaliatory discharge, Section 510 claim.
Well, it's a retaliatory or interference. The fact that
right,
they did.
Right, but the prohibited action under the statute that you've argued is the discharge. Is that a fair way to conceptualize your claim, or are you alleging that there was some other prohibited action taken by the defendants constituted interference with the reserve?
Well, the interference was the fact that under the law, the only bargaining agent was the Teamsters, and that if you wanted to modify or alter the plan, or if you wanted to discontinue the plan, ERISA has a framework that you negotiate that, or there's certain
right,
things.
Right. The railroad isn't the sponsor of the plan, though. You are. The Teamsters are.
Well, the railroad created the plan. And the railroad, the key.
That's not alleged in the complaint.
Well, we allege that they own all the instrumentalities of the yard.
Right, but you've alleged that this is a Teamsters created plan. And I understood this to be one of those multi-employer plans that the employer pays into.
It's administered by the Teamsters. The Teamsters have they take the money from whoever is deemed the employer to dump the money into the plan. And so
none of that is very clear from the complaint.
And that may be the case, and that may be the reason we're here. But I believe that the fact is that based on the premise of the case and the fact that we are a notice pleading case, it puts all of the defendants on notice what the predicate of the claim is. And it's all
That gets back to the question that I asked a moment ago about whether this is essentially a discharge claim under Section 510, whether your allegation is that the employees were discharged in violation of Section 510.
That's a part of it, yes.
Is there more to it that
Well, the other part of it is the fact that that they used the agency used the RTS, they used the other union to effectuate this plan.
What part of the statute does that violate?
Well, we find harbor in that argument based on the Ninth Circuit case where they allowed the conspiracy to go through, and then on the two cases that we cite from the Western District of Michigan and the Eastern District.
What part of the statute does that violate?
I'm sorry?
What part of the statute?
It violates, I believe, Section 510, 1144 of the...
language, please.
The language would be...
Section 510 does not supply a conspiracy claim.
Well, I believe... Judge, that it's a natural progression, and it's been allowed in the Sixth Circuit, the Third Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit on the three cases that we cite to, that you can't do something that's illegal to effectuate a termination of a person's right to a benefit, which they were anticipating. And we cite to those cases where you have the insurer, you have the supervisor, and you have a property owner, an intermodal operator, where they were all charged with violating Section 510 of the statute for, in the supervisor's claim, they told the worker, don't make a workman's comp claim, don't make a health benefit claim under your pension plan, which was deemed to be interference, and they were charged for that conduct. There was a case where the insurer indicated to the worker not to make a injury claim because it was covered by the pension plan, and both my understanding of the facts, both the employer, the insurer, the supervisor, they were all deemed to be chargeable for wrongful conduct on the statute.
That's a form of direct liability. Apart from the Ninth Circuit's decision in the intermodal case, no other circuit has recognized a conspiracy claim under Section 510.
That's correct.
Okay. Yes. So why should we follow the Ninth Circuit? Why is that a sound interpretation of the statute?
It's a sound interpretation of the statute because the congressional intent of creating the statute is
start
to safeguard
with the language of the statute.
Yes. It shall be, I'm about to go over my time, it shall be unlawful for any person to discharge, fine, suspend, expel, discipline, or discriminate against a participant or beneficiary for exercising any right to which he's entitled under the provisions of an employee benefit plan, or for the purpose of interfering with the attainment of any right to which such participant may become entitled to under the plan. And it's, we believe, a natural progression based on the plain reading of the statute that this is considered, this would be, this activity as described is an interference because they had an expectation. They've been working there 60 plus years. They had multiple intermodal yard operators have come and go. The railroad at certain times has operated the yard specifically itself. And through these every 10-year cycles, the pension, the Teamsters, the workers have all remained. The thing that changed this time was that Berkshire Hathaway came in, bought the railroad, and decided that we're going to wring more profits out of this. And it shows in their...
Maybe I can focus this a little bit more.
Yes.
Which of the prohibited actions are you hanging your hat on under the statute?
Well, the...
Discharge, expel, suspend, discriminate, go through the list that
okay.
you just read. Which one of those are you invoking
in
this case?
I believe that an argument could be made and is made for interfering.
Interference, I get. I'm talking about the prohibited actions,
Which
are discharge, suspend, expel, discriminate, et cetera.
Well,
there's a laundry list.
Yes.
You have to fit it within one of those as a statutory matter.
And I believe that it was they were discriminated against because they had a pension, and they were all fired wholesale. They had a contract, labor contract. In between that labor contract, the railroad was negotiating with someone else to come in and...
Okay, so now you're arguing this is a discrimination claim under 510 because the other union, which offered less generous benefits, was favored.
Well, that's part of the claim. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, because that's new from the podium.
I'm very sorry I didn't communicate that better. The difficulty is that there's an interplay between the ERISA and the Railroad Act, and once TCIU got the contract, what should have happened was there would be a national contract that governs all of TCIU's employees. But what they specifically did, they did not want that because there's step increases in wage amounts that the company did not want to pay, and they didn't want to pay a pension. So what they did, how they discriminated was by creating a contract, a labor contract, that's specific just to CoreWith. It doesn't involve the national contract. It doesn't involve any of the TCIU workers. It involves just CoreWith, and it was because the discrimination that took place was we do not want to pay a health and welfare, and we don't want to pay a pension. And if we get into the national contract, there's liability for us having to be stuck with a yard of workers that, regardless of who's working there, they're going to get a pension. We don't want to pay the pension. And that's what the discrimination claim is. I've overstayed my...
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I hope I answered your question. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Munro?
Thank you, Your Honor. Donald Munro for BNSF and its affiliated companies. I've divided up the issues with co-counsel, and to that end, I'd like to focus on the Prohibited Act issues that that Your Honor was referencing a moment ago, or the conduct element within Section 510. My main point is that a plaintiff has to allege an act of retaliation or interference with benefits, and a decision to terminate the RTS contract by BNSF simply does not qualify as such an adverse act. The statutory language at issue that opposing counsel referenced a moment ago, discharge, fine, suspend, expel, discipline, or discriminate in retaliation for or to interfere with benefits. I'd like to start with the proposition that that cannot mean that acts that merely have consequences for benefits, that have indirect business effects on third parties, can satisfy the requirement of an adverse act. For example, if you had an automobile manufacturer and you decide, I'm no longer going to buy parts from this third-party company, even if you understand to an absolute certainty that that supplier will then have to lay off workers, that does not constitute an adverse action within the scope of 510. There's not a generalized prohibition on loss of benefits or consequences for third parties. And this Court has said so in Isbell, Meredith, Toomer, a variety of cases that say that, look, it's 510 is not that broad. There has to be some allegation, then, that the defendant made, controlled, directed, influenced the adverse action at issue. And opposing counsel has framed this as a question of employer versus non-employer. I don't think that's the right way to go at this. I'd suggest that there's a two-part inquiry the Court should use in a 510 case of this nature. First, the question that Judge Sykes identified a moment ago. What is the adverse action we're talking about? What caused the harm to the pension rights? That test can be derived from statements in cases like Crawford and Toomer, where the Court said, look, we're looking for something that actually affected the pension benefits. Second, who made that decision? And in this case, if you were to apply that test, you'd have to say that the adverse action here was the termination of employment. If they are not terminated, if the plaintiffs were not let go, then they retain their pension benefits. And who made the decision to terminate them? It was clearly RTS, not BNSF. BNSF is only alleged to have ended the RTS services contract, not to have terminated anyone. RTS retained complete rights to retrain, relocate, furlough. For all we know, there was a collective bargaining agreement that required RTS to discharge people in seniority order, and people at other locations might have lost their jobs. But the point is that there is no allegation in this amended complaint that suggests that BNSF or its affiliated companies had any involvement in that decision.
RTS is completely independent from the railroad, as I understand.
Yes, that's
the
correct.
Allegations. And the collective bargaining agreement, the complaint is vague about this, but the collective bargaining agreement runs between the Teamsters and RTS?
That's correct, yes. And opposing counsel admits this. I mean, you're right. The complaint is rather vague at times, and there are suggestions that there was some employment relationship at some point in the past between these individuals and the railroad. But he clearly admits it at page 4 of his brief, and then in the supplemental appendix in briefing before the district court at pages 29, he again concedes that they were RTS employees. And then his argument, his entire argument that no employment relationship is required, shows you that these were not BNSF employees. In addition, if you were inclined to go beyond their concessions, there's the supplemental appendix that we've provided, which is the RTS services contract, and is referenced in the complaint as very express about who these employees were employed by.
Could this case have been litigated as a 510 discrimination claim?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because that claim would fail for much the same reason. A discrimination by BNSF. Let's assume they could show the requisite intent, that BNSF, for whatever reason...
Yep, that's a summary judgment issue.
Let's assume that they've shown that. To then allege discrimination, there has to be some interference or retaliation. And here you have a causal gap. Let me put it this way. Suppose the act of discrimination was, well, starting tomorrow, we're going to make everybody dress in blue. You can't wear any other color on our property. And they do that because they hate pension benefits. Well, so what? I mean, it doesn't have any impact at all on their benefits. And the same is true with respect to this act. Let's assume BNSF says, we don't like the Teamster benefits. We're going to cancel the RTS services contract. Again, it's so what? The RTS employees retain their pension benefits unless they are fired. And that is a separate decision that RTS controls, not BNSF. Let me give you another analogy. Suppose BNSF is a landlord and says, we're canceling your lease. At that point, BNSF has no control or even knowledge as to what will happen next. The tenant could say, we're going to go out of business because we lost our lease. They could say, we're going to relocate to a larger facility and hire more people. Unless there is some allegation that BNSF reached into the business decisions of RTS, there's nothing actionable here.
So this is an absence of a causal connection kind of argument, as opposed to a theoretical argument that this couldn't be litigated as a discrimination claim. It might have been, but even if it had been, then there would be an absence of causation because of the separation between RTS and the railroad?
Causation is an alternative path to the same outcome, Your Honor. This court recently said in Nauman that Section 510 requires but-for causation. It didn't say. It indicated that 510 requires but-for causation. And you have if you approach it from that angle, you get to the same place because there's no but-for causation here. RTS made an independent decision, and therefore the BNSF actions did not cause the alleged harm to pension benefits. I see I'm out of time, unless there are any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Monroe. Mr. Perry.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Cliff Perry. I represent Rail Terminal Services, Rail Management Services, and Carrick's in this case, referenced in the briefs as the RTS defendants. I'll be referring to them here as well in the same manner. Your Honors, the principal issue in this case from our perspective is whether the plaintiffs have set forth a plausible claim for relief under Section 510, which, as we know, makes it unlawful to terminate an employee for the purpose of interfering with the attainment of ERISA benefits. Our position is that because the plaintiffs had failed to allege any facts stating a plausible claim, we ask that this Court would affirm the District Court's dismissal of the plaintiff's amended complaint as to the RTS defendants. As we know, RTS was a contractor for BNSF, assisting the railroad in operating the Corwith Yard from 2000 until January of 2011. Plaintiffs allege in their amended complaint that BNSF terminated the contract with RTS sometime in 2010, that BNSF brought the loading function previously performed by RTS in-house effective January 2011. In other words, BNSF fired RTS. As a result of being fired, plaintiffs admit that RTS likewise terminated plaintiff's employment. And in spite of pleading in their amended complaint that RTS fired the plaintiffs as a result of its own termination by BNSF, plaintiffs conclude without alleging any facts in support of this conclusion that RTS terminated them with the specific intent of avoiding its ERISA obligations to the plaintiffs. In this case, the plaintiffs are alleging nothing more than the fact that they were terminated from their jobs and there was a corresponding loss of benefits. There's no causal link between the two. The problem with plaintiffs' conclusion is that they fail to allege any facts permitting this court to infer the plausibility of a Section 510 violation. In fact, the plaintiffs' conclusion as to the RTS defendants is counterintuitive. The common sense interpretation of the facts that are pled is that RTS did not want to get fired. RTS, had it wanted to cease operating at Corwith, merely had to not renew its contract with the railroad. Indeed, the plaintiffs have not pled otherwise in their amended complaint. There's no allegation to the contrary in their amended complaint. And without pleading any facts to the contrary, it is simply implausible to conclude that RTS wanted to be terminated or that it would do anything to get itself terminated, particularly where it didn't need to do that if it wanted to cease operating at CoreWith. Further, the plaintiffs admit in their amended complaint and in their briefs filed with this court and with the district court below that RTS terminated plaintiffs only as a result of its own termination by the railroad, and plaintiffs have not pled that RTS had any control over the railroad's decision. There's no allegation like that in the amended complaint. The only thing that's been alleged is that RTS was fired, and therefore the plaintiffs were fired as well. So although the plaintiffs have pled that they were fired, although they have pled that they have consequently lost their benefits, they have failed to plead any facts suggesting a causal link between the two.
Well, the more precisely focused question is whether RTS acted with the purpose of interfering with ERISA rights or the attainment of ERISA benefits. And that's the problem here. I mean, there was a causal link. They were terminated, so they lost their benefits. But the question is whether there was an improper purpose.
There's been no allegation in the amended complaint, aside from the legal conclusion that specific intent and that purpose existed. There's no communications reference. There's no documents reference. There's no evidence of any other kind referencing a reason why RTS would have terminated these employees with the specific intent of avoiding its ERISA obligations. The only allegation is that we were fired. There's no allegation that we could have done anything else with these employees. Although Mr. Monroe indicated that he doesn't know, and the plaintiffs apparently don't either because it wasn't alleged in the complaint, what RTS could have done with these employees, the fact is that they were terminated, and that's the only thing that we can assume could have resulted from its own termination by BNSF. I see I'm out of time. Unless there's any questions, so we'll rest on our briefs.
Thank you, Mr. Perry. Mr. Harper.
Your Honors, may it please the Court, my name is Skelly Harper. I represent Transportation Communications International Union. Respectfully, we're still unclear why we were named as a defendant in this case. On the one hand, our only involvement is that we engaged in lawful collective bargaining with the BNSF. But on the other hand, in the amended complaint, the plaintiffs specifically disavow that their claims relate at all to collective bargaining agreement. They state their claims are totally independent of and in no way relates to any collective bargaining agreement. They state, nor does it relate to or depend upon any statements made in the context of any collective bargaining agreement. So just there, the only involvement we have has been completely disavowed to relate to the claims. They cannot proceed. We're not a proper defendant. We have no relation to this case. But even if they hadn't made that disavowal, lawful collective bargaining is just not an activity which is unlawful under 510. Second, they've also disavowed their claims entirely by specifying why TCU negotiated in the way they negotiated. In the reply brief, they state the specific intent of TCU was to get the CoreWith labor contract from Local 705. That is not to interfere. That is not to retaliate. They've specified the specific intent, and it's not a specific intent that violates 510. Again, they've completely disavowed any type of hypothetical viable claim. And the last point I'd like to make is just that they cannot tether TCU to this action through some allegation of conspiracy. First of all, there's no viable 510 conspiracy claim. They cite a state court case, but a state court claim of conspiracy would clearly be preempted, as the court below held and is clear under Supreme Court law. They reference a federal common law conspiracy. There's no federal common law conspiracy in violation of ERISA. As the court noted, the statutory language would have to support a conspiracy claim. There's just nothing in the statutory language that supports a conspiracy claim. There's no legal basis to assert a conspiracy claim.
What about the Ninth Circuit precedent?
The Ninth Circuit did not recognize Our reading of the case is that the Ninth Circuit did not recognize a separate conspiracy claim. In that case, what the Ninth Circuit did was use the word conspiracy, and what they analogized the action to was an insurer who would coerce an employer to fire someone in order to avoid paying benefits. So it's a direct action, even in that case, that was alleged for the purpose of interference. It wasn't some type of indirect liability without a direct action. So even there, it's a reading of a direct action, which they referred to as a conspiracy, but it was covered under the statutory language as a direct action for liability.
Well, the Ninth Circuit did go further in the intermodal case than it had before in the case that you've just described, the insurance company case, which was a direct action case. Intermodal really did sound in conspiracy, or at least that's how I read the case, but I question whether that's a sound interpretation of the statute. And I assume you'd agree with that.
Right. So if the court would read intermodal that way, we would respectfully submit that the statutory language just simply doesn't support such a reading of the statute. And then just a final point on the conspiracy, that even if there were some type of legal basis in some situation to allege a conspiracy claim, that here there are no factual allegations that support a plausible conspiracy. The allegation against the TCU is that they were played off each other, and the TCU there's no allegations that support that. And I see my time's up.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Harper. Mr. Kefalos?
Yes, sir. Quick rebuttal. The complaint does specifically say that through this activity, the $2.4 million was saved in a pension cost, and it was communicated to the union through the railroad by RTS that we need to save money. We need to get this cut back. And while clearly TCIU had no business negotiating a contract when the collective agent, bargaining agent, was the Teamsters, until the Teamsters legally were out, no longer involved with the yard. Another specific distinction I would like to make is everyone keeps talking about no facts, no evidence. Those are summary judgment standards. This is a 12B6 plausibility standard. The gravamen of the appeal is that we should have been allowed to just to replead, unless the court could say specifically point to a fact or a law that says there's no way that you can succeed on this. And we believe, based on the case law cited, that there is a plausible and that there are facts.
Let me just ask you this. Do you believe the complaint is clear on who is doing the termination? It seems to me, within the context of the complaint, you seem to suggest in some areas that it's the railroad, and in others, not. You speak of RTS, for example, informing the Teamsters they would be terminated, and in other sections, you seem to suggest that the railroad will deliver the pink slips. What do you make of those seemingly
I think
different allegations?
The confusion is, and the difficulty in pleading this case is, there are multiple communications going on at multiple times. Sometimes the communication is directly by the railroad. It's either through a memo or some type of posting with BNSF letterhead, or it's through RTS, or it's through one of the parent RTS companies, or it's through they used to call it a town hall meeting. And you'd have representatives from the railroad or representatives from Carrix or whomever communicating that the intent was, hey, guys, if you don't cut back on this pension obligation cost, then we're going to get rid of you. And ultimately, that's what happened. And all we're asking for and it's fine if it's going to be dismissed on 12B6 grounds. All we're asking for is a 12B6 standard, not a 12E standard, because it appears to my reading of the district court's opinion is there are not enough facts. He actually says at page 5, he labels the section not enough facts. Well, if there's not enough facts, why would you enter a final judgment? You should have at least said, if you can plead this, come back to me. And that's all we're asking because...
Well, did you make a request to file an amended complaint in this case?
We did not, based on the judge's the fact that he filed the final judgment and he was not we did not believe that he was that there were any set of facts that we could plead and that a clarification in this circuit on the other circuit case law that we've cited would be good for the development of law in this area.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kellogg. All right. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the second case of the day.